Chapter 2. Terra, the Imperial Palace. The shuttle deployed its landing struts for its final descent stage onto daylight pad theta. The light void craft wobbling in the crosswinds generated by the perpetual grind of the palace hive's colossal cycler fans and the sheer volume of air traffic. Transorbital lighters were picking up and setting down in a near constant flow, crowding the palace's skyline, red and purple and black and gold, a swirling plasteel snow of new conscripts pressed into the Navy's proudest regiments. To navigate a shuttle through either obstacle, let alone both, was a task closer to reading the Emperor's tarot than landing a void craft. To even make the attempt took the superhuman reflexes and unshakable confidence of the Adeptus Astartes. Corland, Chapter Master of the Imperial Fists, looked up to watch the shuttle's approach. Waves of promethium heat beat down on him, and the roar of the angling turbofans rippled his lips and cheeks, but his eyes stayed open despite the onslaught. The Templar crosses emblazoned on white panels on the shuttle's nose and underwing appeared to resize as aerofoils made minute adjustments. Jets of air from lateral stabilization thrusters held it level. Roused from torpor by the approaching lander, and flushed of soporific neurosedatives, servitors bonded to caterpillar-tracked motive assemblies moved haltingly forwards against the jet wash. Lengths of bright orange vulcanized hosing played out behind them, the oil-washed outlet valves supplanting superfluous hands and emerging from artificially gaping mouths flanked by mind-wiped stares. The shuttle touched down within the innermost ring of blinking guidelights and eased onto its landing struts. The roar of its turbofans became a whine, and gases hissed from heat flues and radiator grills, equalizing pressure and temperature across the shuttle's glowing heat shields. One of the servitor units sprayed the shuttle with super-cooled carbon dioxide vapor. Another trundled underneath, frozen gases crystallizing its slack features, and nozzled its wrist adapter over the shuttle's filler pipe. It emitted a guzzling noise, smoking under the white hiss of venting gases. Either side of Corland, an honor detail of human and another of not-quite-human troopers endeavored to stand crisply at attention, despite the successive waves of engine heat and coolant that came at them from the middle of the pad. The men were all tall and hard-faced, in black uniforms with red piping and frogging, armsmen of the Navy's symbolic flagship, the Royal Bark. Each wore the Royal Bark's forbidding ensign on their shoulder, in place of the usual regimental insignia, a sheathed cutlass and a pair of ceremonial red gloves. They were the Navy's elite protection detail, and only the highest-ranking admirals and most influential of visiting dignitaries warranted such bodyguards. In this instance, the subject of their care was Rear Admiral Pervez Leshento of the Tiamat-class battleship Dies Dominus. The name was High Gothic for Lord of Daylight. An extraordinary coincidence, or Lansung was honeying Corland's gruel a little thickly. On the other side were the Scitari of the Basilicon Astra, the exploratory fleets of Mars, visored, cloaked in dark, energy-dense robes worn over a bio-augmented flesh carapace and an assortment of techno-esoterica. Corland doubted that the cyberguised warriors suffered the extremes of heat and cold gushing out from the shuttle pad, but the jet wash was certainly fighting them over their heavy cloaks. The commander of the maniple was a Magos explorator named Benzine. He was wrapped up to his throat in deep red robes woven with a machina opus. From the odd, twitching motions that occasionally stirred these robes, they were to protect the sensibilities of those he moved amongst rather than for his own benefit. Hololithic equations hovered about a millimeter in front of his black chrome facial dish from a miniaturized projector embedded somewhere amidst the array of fluttering sensors. The Tagmata of Mars had fulfilled their obligations in the Last War's assault on the Orc attack moon, limited though they were, and the Fabricator General was not about to relinquish control of that orbiting planetoid of Xenotech now. As Corland waited, a pair of hypersonic lightning interceptors rocketed overhead, the second surfing on its leader's contrail. An expanding, rolling boom rattled the ornamental flak turrets of Dawn's Spire and the leaded windows of the Walk of Heroes on the other side of the killing ground. The golden vexillum of the daylight militia that flew from the plasteel-plated turrets of the Cathedral of St. Clementine the Absolver bent after the passing fighters. Courland looked up to catch them, but even his gen-harnessed eyes were too slow. Instead, distorted by stained plexiglass and cracked UV shielding, he saw the Orc Moon. Its cratered face glared down through a tangle of piping, as if it always knew exactly when and where to look to find him. It was far smaller than Terra's own moon, but hanging in geostationary orbit just a few hundred kilometers above the Sanctum Imperialis, it appeared 10 times larger. The larger vessels of the blockading fleet, Autocephalax Eternal, Dies Dominus, and Abhorrence, being but 3, were visible from Terra, like clouds passing slowly over the face of the hostile alien planetoid. Corlint himself knew no fear, but despite the visual reassurance, he could well understand the terror the Orc Moon instilled in people. Even those who would never see the sky could feel its power over their world. A tremor passed through the mountainous bastion of Daylight Wall. Unsecured maintenance hatches rattled. Fern-like communications vanes hummed, the indelicate side-to-side motion transformed into harmonic vibrations. The mighty fortifications moved, as they had been designed to move under tectonic stresses or the crushing overpressure of an artillery bombardment, but their superficial facades crumbled, tank-sized chunks of ornamental masonry crashing down into the killing fields and the underhives. Cabling tore, electrical, hydraulic, plasmic, and ionized gases and pressurized fluids sprayed photochemical ejecta into the palace twilight. The shaking eased. The shouts of rescue and repair units filtered up from below. Things were not at least as dire as they had become on Adamantua. The last wall and Basilicon Astra's bombardment had obliterated the attack moon's weaponry along with about 95% of its crust. No, this was not a weapon. This was simply the seismic shock of having a lunar body suddenly transposed into near orbit. He looked across the fretted robes of the Skitarii, dazzling the air with arcane symbology, to where Daylight stood on the opposite side of the platform, with his back against the steep drop to the palace. The Fist's exemplar battle brother who had taken the name, formerly 7th Captain Dentor, looked good in his new livery, as much as it pained Corlan to compel his brother to wear it. He knew the value that the Warrior's Home chapter placed on outward humility and inward pride. The golden spear and shield he carried were not the same as those borne by his namesake, for they too had been victims of Adamantua's destruction, but had been selected for him from the chapter's armories on the basis of being a good enough likeness to fool anyone who was not a son of Dawn. To his dishonor, it did feel good to share his wall with a brother again, and Lord Udo had been right. The populace appreciated the sight of Imperial fists on the walls. Daylight nodded the all clear, and Courland returned it. In a squeal of hydraulics, the shuttle's boarding hatch lowered. The ramp struck the platform with a dull metallic thump, flexing and rattling as if in the grip of another quake, as the power-armored High Marshal of the Black Templars emerged through the coolant vapors. Beaumont's face was a burned ruin, scorched by the witchfire of an orc psyker in a battle long before the present uprising. Half of what remained was a metal mask, as emotive as the chrome plate of the Magos Explorator. But the other half was what struck terror into mortals and transhumans alike. It was flesh, but it could not be called a face. Looking at it, you could see where flesh had run, where it had re-solidified, as he beat the green-skinned witch to death with his bare fists and the new form it had taken. Courland was not above a slight feeling of intimidation. Whatever he felt was amplified in the mortal soldiery tenfold. The idea that they might offer any protection at all against even the one space marine was laughable. The High Marshal carried Sigismund's sword in one gauntleted fist, drawn, the long blade angled away from him and towards the ground. The other hand he presented, palm up, and waited for half a second while a warrior bondsman in bone-coloured flak armour and black surplice slapped a data slate into it. It looked as though he was about to launch into some kind of prepared speech, but Courland had come to know him better than that. "The last coordinates of every Black Templar's Crimson Fists, Excoriators and Iron Knight's ship in the blockade fleet, and the codes to our defensive installations in the base's interior." Beaumont's mouth no longer closed properly, and the expression he made was a loathsome sneer. "I advise you to memorize them. By the High Lord's decree, there remain enough orcs in the deeper levels to occupy your surface teams." Beaumont looked from Benzine to Lashento, waving the slate back and forth in his giant's hand, as though hoping the two men might fight each other to be the one to have it. Neither would have dared. With a scowl, the High Marshal tossed the slate dismissively into the hands of one of the Royal Bark's soldiers. The information could have been delivered by data burst, but the wheels of Terran bureaucracy were greased by such petty ceremonies. The Skitarii and Navy men filed out, the single Adeptus Arbites enforcer guarding the steps down to the fifth-tier battlements saluted the Magos Explorator and the Rear Admiral. Courland was uncertain what she was there for. He smiled slightly. His protection, he presumed. As the last of the men disappeared down the steps, Beaumont strode across the platform and clasped Courland by the forearm. Courland returned the pressure on the High Marshal's elbow guard.
"It is good to see a friendly face, brother."
"Is that a joke?"
Courland grunted, amused, but no longer seemed to feel like smiling. They released each other's arms and stepped back, almost wary.
"You have not come around to Udo's edict, I take it," Courland said. "If he wishes to disperse the chapters, then I say let him try and make us. Mind what you say, brother. Your anger at the High Lord's ingratitude is understandable. I share it. But it is because of thoughts like these that we must disperse."
"I do not care about their ingratitude," Beaumont muttered darkly. "It is their ineptitude that concerns me.
If it will keep the council on my side, then having you and the others join the Fist's Exemplar at Fal is a small price. And if the orcs simply lie in wait for such an opening, there could be millions yet in the Attack Moon's core, biding their time. And as the Mechanicus did not permit us to delve deeper, we cannot say for certain that we destroyed the only teleportation device they have. Fal is little more than a month away at worst, and 50 Space Marine veterans is no token force.
To be counted amongst a Space Marine chapter's finest was no small thing. And from the first companies of the Fist's Exemplar, Black Templars, Crimson Fists, Excoriators, and Iron Knights, Courland had reconstituted the Shield Corps. Daylight, Hemisphere, Tranquility. Bastion Ledge, Ballard Gate, Zarathustra, Lotus Gate. He meant no disrespect to the Lucifer Blacks who had stepped up to fill the Imperial fist-sized breach in Fortress Terra, but they were not Space Marines. War would undoubtedly come again to the Imperial Palace, and when it did, then, like the arch-traitor before them, the orcs would meet walls defended by the Sons of Dawn.
"Can you hold for that long?" said Beaumont. "It is ground, brother. I can hold it."
Beaumont revealed his twisted grin as if he were showing off a knife, and he nodded across Curran's shoulder. The enforcer had approached and halted about 2 meters away and threw a salute.
"I know you, enforcer," said Courland.
The part of the woman's face that was visible between her chin straps and visor seemed suddenly to glow. It was a look that Courland had become wearily familiar with amongst the palace's mortal defenders, the sort of look reserved for saints and saviours.
"Galatea Hass, Lord, and..."
She rolled her shoulder to show her rank stripes.
"It's Proctor now."
She bit her lip, as though worried she might have offended her transhuman lord by wasting his time with something as trivial as mortal hierarchies, then added tentatively,
"You remember me?"
I seldom forget, said Corland. Thank the Emperor for designing me thus.
I will.
Praise be, Beaumont murmured. Can I help you, Proctor?
Yes, Lord. She snapped another salute and held it. The Provost Colonel demands the return of Daylight Pad Theta to the Adeptus Arbites.
Tell her no. Haas smiled.
Thank you, Lord.
With a growl, Beaumont turned his back on the woman, who reached barely as high as his elbow, and made to head back to his shuttle.
They demand your protection, but only so long as you do not inconvenience their little fiefdoms. I'll leave you to it, brother, and may I never find myself embroiled in politics again.
Corland nodded his agreement.
From my shuttle, I saw rioters outside the Great Chamber itself. I'm not surprised. They should be put down, rumbled the fourth Space Marine present, Eternity, standing at the near edge of the platform opposite Daylight.
The expression of such dissent within the palace grounds is a capital sin.
The Black Templar, who had become Eternity, had demanded that wall and that duty, had insisted that he be the last line between the custodians and the rest of the universe. He, more than anyone, served as a reminder that an imperial fist was more than just the colours that he wore. Haas looked towards the towering wall brother, a sudden wariness, fear even, causing her face to tense, as if she had heard this particular Black Templar's voice before.
Go to them then, brother, said Corland,
turning to meet the glowing red lenses of Eternity's helm.
Let them see that they are safe, that it is an imperial fist that walks amongst them.
He glanced to Haas. The woman was almost shaking, worse than when she had been rescued from the Orcs' captivity.
Let them all see.